Okay, so this evening I've been requested to speak on the Dhamma, but also keeping to a theme or a subject that has been, I think, this whole month. People who are invited to speak here at BIA are being asked to speak on the same kind of subject. New year, new life, life can be improved. And this is a little saying that well, of course, there's a translation, but a small saying that Ajahn Buddhadasa himself used. And so I think it's a good theme to explore, this sense of as so often happens, as the new year is coming, and people start making New Year's resolutions, thinking of what they're going to do for the new year that's different from the old year, and usually the New Year's resolutions usually last about 6 hours or something. So there, that's usually not a particularly fruitful exercise oftentimes. Are usually my New Year's resolutions used to be like that anyway. But I think with from reflecting from the place of the Buddha's teachings, this recognition that one, that it's an arbitrary assignment, that there is a new year, but the reality is that we can bring new life into whatever we're doing at any point in time. And that establishing of a an awareness of that this is a new life. This evening's a new evening, and tomorrow's a new day, and we can bring a sense of determination to make skillful use of that, and I think it is helpful to make that conscious. There's a very well known discourse of the Buddha's where the Buddha is pointing out that the past, the past is gone. The future is really unknown. But to be able to make each presently arisen phenomena, bringing it to awareness, bringing it to a sense of taking responsibility for it, that's where change can actually happen. So to the sense that life can be improved, and we can be making choices that allow us to to really improve our perspectives, our conduct, our quality of heart. This afternoon I was talking to the group that was here about the word that's usually used by the Buddha when we think about meditation, and the word in the scriptural language is bhavana, and it's actually the same word that the Thais have taken and kind of Sanskritized it, and Thai Sanskritized it and made it into patana, which means again to develop, to improve, to make better in some way, and so that our efforts at the cultivation and development of the path that the Buddha has laid down gives us an opportunity for establishing a very new and fresh approach to our existence. So that particularly the development of mindfulness is an important foundation, because the mindfulness is the basis by which we can bring a sense of clarity to our experience. And whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, whether it's wanted, unwanted, whether it's something we like or we dislike, we can be mindful of it. We can be aware very clearly of what that experience is. As we become aware of that, we can be more clear with the choices that we make. Improvement, development, cultivation that we do has to rely on a clarity of the within the way that we choose our actions in body, speech, and mind. Because so often we actually we don't choose; we just do it unconsciously. We do it mindlessly. We do it out of habit. We do things just following the world around us, there's so often a distinct lack of clarity in the choices that we make, and to cultivate mindfulness gives us a foundation to be making skillful choices. Because the reality is, whether we make a skillful choice or not in our actions of body, speech, and mind, we receive the fruits of those actions. We say something that is timely, that is kind, we receive the fruits of that. We say something that is kind of negative, critical, confrontational, we receive the fruits of that. So that making sure that we are as clear as possible, because there's a big difference between the results of something that is negative and unskillful and something that is wholesome and skillful. And certainly what we actually want is to be happy, to experience well-being, and to be, you know, somewhat peaceful. It is dependent on these choices that we make. So that to be bringing a conscious awareness to our actions of body, speech, and mind, so that we can facilitate the experience of well-being. And when one puts it as stark as that, you think, well, that should be pretty easy. And of course, then you know the reality of our interactions and social complications and our own habits and tendencies keep sort of dragging us along in ways that we keep coming back to, you know, why am I suffering again? And so it's just this sense of, okay, we really being able to remind ourselves of our this fact that, okay, we can improve, we can cultivate, we can develop, and that's a, you know, I think of Ajahn Chah, my own teacher, he'd give very simple examples to illustrate that, in a sense, because we cultivate and practice, and we, you know, we want to be mindful, we want to be peaceful, we want to have wisdom and discernment, but it takes time. And Ajahn Chah sort of saying, yeah, and it does take time. It's like a child when you first go to school and you first start to learn how to write. And then you first start to learn how to write, and the letters aren't very neat, they're not very straight, they're not very even, it doesn't look very beautiful. As you continue to practice the writing, a child continues to be diligent in learning the writing, and it starts to flow, and it's legible, and it's beautiful. And it's all through just that practice and training. Say myself as a monk, and particularly in Ajahn Chah's tradition, one of the basic things that we do is, we sew our own robes. And when you first start to sew robes, it can be pretty messy. You don't come out, you don't get the most beautiful robe the first time you sew a robe. And it takes time, even just to sit down and learn how to use a sewing machine. Sometimes you actually have to get the coordination going without any cloth or thread in the machine. You just want to sort of learn how to get that stupid machine to keep going. But then, after a while, you practice with it, you train with it, and then you you get to actually sew pretty basic things, and then you develop those skills, and you keep building on those skills, and after time, you're able to complete a whole robe, it's just through that practice and training. And I think that's one of the characteristics of the Buddha's teaching, is that emphasis on practice and training. That it's not about thinking through some philosophical analysis of the universe. It's not about just having some kind of faith and devotion in an ideal. It's about taking on a training and continuing to practice and work with that training. And the training is about training our body, speech, and mind. So that learning how to pay attention to the results of our actions, and then being willing to take on a training that helps those fundamentals of our existence, our actions of body, speech, and mind, to bear fruit in well-being, in happiness, in clarity. And it's something that we can do, something that's possible. I mean, it's one of the, to me, one of the very beautiful discourses of the Buddha, where the Buddha it's a very simple statement, just saying that this training can be accomplished by you. If it wasn't possible for you to reap the fruits of this training, I wouldn't teach it. So it's just sort of, right. So this is the things that the Buddha is teaching. He's giving us the tools to cultivate, to develop, to practice, and allow us to experience the fruits and dwell in those fruits. But it is important to reflect on how do we train with this? How do we work with it? And I think the the Noble Eightfold Path of the Buddhas, which is in the teachings, is the path that the Buddha laid out for the cessation of suffering. Traditionally, it's broken down into three kind of areas or groupings, and they're actually called the three trainings. So that in Pali, the Trai Sikha, so they're training, and so the training in virtue. So it is around precepts, around conduct, and I think certainly for those of us who grew up in a Western or Judeo-Christian culture, then our relationship to kind of precepts and moral injunctions it usually has that flavor of being a commandment. And yeah, I don't know about anybody else, when somebody commands me to do something, I tend to resist. So that it's like I think we're all like that as human beings. In some ways, training the mind is like that. We sort of command it to do something. It's sort of like a cat. Even if you put some food out for a cat and then you go push it, go and eat that. You know, what's a cat do? I mean, it doesn't sort of comply. it just digs its paws in and says, like, back off. Don't. And, you know, our mind does that. But the relationship to, say, with moral precepts, virtue, from a Buddhist perspective, is training. And and that's embedded in the language, like when we're taking the precepts, the the phrase, like for the five precepts, the first precept in the scriptural language, panatipata werlapmani sikkhapadang sammadhiyami. I mean, one is that we're the verb sammadhiyami, which means to determine, or to undertake. You know, I undertake to do this, and the word that we translate as a precept is from the word sikkha padam, and it's a two word together. Pada is literally foot, but it means like the basis or the foundation, and sikkha of course is training. So sikkha padam, sort of the basis of training. So I undertake the basis of training to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. So it's a very different approach, say, than a commandment, something that one that we take on ourselves, and then recognizing that we're taking it on as a basis for training ourselves. And training, in the Buddha's perspective, is actually engaging in the, you know, activity of okay, how does it work? What happens? What's the result? What are the obstacles I have as I take this on? And the sikkha in which is that training. In Sanskrit, is siksa, which is what in the Thai language is to like a to study, to learn, and it has that whole spectrum. So, like practicing is studying and learning. So we're using our actions to study and learn. How do we engage in a way that doesn't create conflict? How do we engage in a way that doesn't create disharmony? How do we engage in a way that develops trust and well-being? Of course, that's the purpose of the precepts, establishing our conduct of body and speech in a way that establishes trust and non-remorse. So that sense of, that's an immediate fruit of keeping within the bounds of precepts, is that there's no basis for regret or remorse. And that's a big deal. You can think of how many times you sort of, you go back with that kind of regret, God, I wish I hadn't said that. And you know, it was just, you know, and you think, and there's that regret there, that remorse. Oh, I should have been more kind, or I should have been more sensitive. But, you know, but that's part of the training. So, and that takes mindfulness. This is where the path works together. So that the when we think of this, the three trainings, both in the virtue, meditation, wisdom, our virtue is trained in conjunction with the meditation aspects and the wisdom aspects. They have to support each other. They have to feed each other. They need to kind of interact and connect with each other. because they they're mutually supportive, so that when, you know, in terms of our actions and speech, just establishing the those meditative aspects, or the training in meditation, there's a training in kind of effort or application of energy, or application of mindfulness and awareness, attention, and then being able to settle and establish the mind firmly. Those are the training in the mind training that meditation is trying to accomplish, is giving the skills where we can apply our effort and energy to things without getting distracted, without burning ourselves out, and getting a balance in application of effort and energy, having the ability to be mindful. Mindful, in from the Buddha's perspective, the Buddha rarely uses the word mindfulness standing alone. It's almost always in conjunction with the quality of clear comprehension. So mindfulness and clear comprehension go together. So there isn't such thing as mindfulness that excludes things or is not attentive to the circumstances and the implications of our actions. That's one of the necessary aspects of mindfulness, is that it's actually it's sensitive and tuned to the time and place, sensitive and attuned to the people, persons. It's sensitive and attuned to the results that are going to take place. It's sensitive and attuned to a relinquishing of kind of a selfish interest, or to be doing things in a way that is, based in non-delusion, say, rather than delusion and clouded, so that these are in our training of mindfulness. It's not just to be so focused on something, thinking that just being mindful of one little thing is going to be enough. The way the mind works is that, just as I can look down and see the clock there, and I can see it, what it's doing, but there's all sorts of other things happening around it, and that's a part of the mindfulness, is seeing the context of our actions, seeing the context of our relationship with ourselves and others, so that cultivation of mindfulness is not narrow. It's an actual, a broad and clear way of relating to the world around us. And of course, the ability to have that, establishing the mind firmly, is having the stability of mind that isn't easily shaken by the contact with the kind of natural experience of things that you like or you dislike, the things that are pleasurable or are not pleasurable, and you're recognizing that, yeah, those are, it's ordinary to experience, like to experience something that is pleasing, and you know, we like it. You know, isn't a reason to get all excited and gratified, and you know, get absorbed in it to the point of forgetting that, as pleasurable as anything could be, it's still going to change. It's still impermanent. It's still based on all sorts of conditions in order for it to be there. Exactly the same thing with something that is not pleasurable, not something that we want, that we even like. But we can still be present with it and not be shaken, and not be, you know, get overwhelmed. Because that's usually what we do, is we tend to project the way we would like things to be, and try to manipulate conditions so that they're pleasing to us, and then we resent when that it isn't, to be able to have the internal clarity and adaptability that, yeah, we can be even and clear in whatever circumstance we're in. A good example of that is as a story that Ajahn Sumedho, who's the senior Western disciple of Ajahn Chah, tells of his experience with Ajahn Chah in the early days of his training with Ajahn Chah. And particularly Ajahn Sumedho was a pioneer, in the sense that he was the first Westerner, and for many years he was the only Westerner living with Ajahn Chah. And so that it takes a while to have the language skills to understand what's going on around, and it could be quite frustrating at times. And then in those days, Ajahn Sumedho is very keen on meditation, very focused, so that he used to resent the times when he had to do group work activities, which is actually every day, and at Wat Pho Phong, at Ajahn Chah's monastery. But the thing that is his real pet peeve was sweeping. Because they come out and sweep, and sweep the leaves, and then you be sweeping, and yes, you sweep this, and they're falling right behind you. Then they say, "What's the use? I could be meditating on my kuti rather than chasing these leaves around." One day it was really, and of course he wasn't enthusiastic about it, so then he would come out, the bell would ring for the sweeping, and he'd come out, usually be about the last person, and of course all that's left is some scraggly broom that isn't very much fun to sweep with anyway. So he was feeling sorry for himself and irritated by sweeping. He was just standing there, kind of glum. Ajahn Chah, who's usually a very astute observer of human nature, he came up to just walk past Ajahn Chah and sort of stopped, smiled, and sort of said, "Oh, is Wat Pho Phong suffering?" And then he walked off. And then sort of, and he said, thinking, and then got Ajahn Sumedho thinking, and I said, "It's what Wakpapong suffering? I certainly suffer at Wakpapong, but Wakpapong's actually a really nice place." So that seeing that, Wakpapong and the things that we do and different duties, none of that is actually suffering. I'm not asked to do anything immoral, inappropriate. It's all actually good things that I'm asked to do. But I still make it suffering myself. So it's sort of separating that out, recognition of, yes, something can be unpleasant, but we don't have to suffer over it. We don't have to create a problem around it. We don't have to resent it or get swept up in it in some way that actually undermines our well-being and peace of mind. So that, and again, that's where, say, the training, the mind training, the meditation training of being able to establish the mind firmly helps that clarity in order to see things and to see through things. But then it also works with the aspect of wisdom. Wisdom is not just some kind of theoretical formula that one applies to Buddhist wisdom, but it's the wisdom and discernment to see things in their inner true nature, and particularly the perspective that the Buddha is always trying to get us to pay attention to is what is it that creates suffering? How do we free ourselves from suffering? That's a really important framework to be investigating. When we think of the wisdom that the Buddha is encouraging us towards, it's always towards that. How do we see through things so clearly that we don't have to pick up any suffering? Again, another example from Ajahn Chah, where at one point Ajahn Chah brought in these very large sort of boundary marker stones into the monastery to be around the kind of the ordination hall, and they marked the boundaries, but there was many left over, so that he kind of arranged it into these kind of a garden area. And so there's these big stones in the grounds of Wakpapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery. And I remember him one time, they were walking past and asking, "Is that stone heavy?" And of course, you look at it, it's just this huge stone. Yeah, it's really heavy, it's big. And he says, "It's not heavy if you don't pick it up." And I said, "Oh, okay. Right." You know, and it's like the same thing. Yeah, is there suffering in the world? Is there suffering and a reality? Yeah, if you pick it up. So that having the clarity and the wisdom to not be picking it up. And this is a training, because we keep picking it up. And to be able to training ourselves to have the integrity of contact, integrity of conduct, the clarity of mind, and the kind of that view, that perspective, that's attending to things in their true nature, seeing things as they are, and giving ourselves the option of opting out of suffering, rather than, because it's something we volunteer for. We're volunteering for more suffering, but we can do the opposite. We can be giving our attention to the things that allow us to experience this well-being and clarity, peace. So these are things that we can develop, we can cultivate. This is what the practice is for. So that let's say those three trainings, the Trisika, this training in virtue, in meditation, in discernment, we can continue to work with and refine and develop a skill in being able to choose to stay with what is peaceful and clear, and relinquish that which is suffering and creates dis-ease within us. So that leave those thoughts with you there for your reflection, and sort of as a perspective or some thoughts on that phrase of new year, new life. Life can be improved, and also open it up for some questions. We've got enough time to give people the opportunity to ask questions.
If someone has a question, please raise your hand. We'll keep the questions short and to the point for Ajahn to easily give an answer.
I'm not quite sure how to ask this question. What struck me was what you just said a while ago when you said that the stone being heavy, but you won't know it's heavy unless you pick it up, and it's just like suffering. You don't have to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of in a stage where I'm kind of battling a loss in my life, and I'm suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I didn't pick up that stone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was flung at me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well,
I'm not quite sure how to deal.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually the second session I've ever attended on Buddhism.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
It's like I'm actually Catholic, but I'm open because
mm-hmm.
I'm not finding that helpful enough for what
mm-hmm.
I'm going through.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things is that especially from a Buddhist perspective. That sense of experiencing some loss or some thing in life that is unwanted, and just as you expressed it, saying that it was flung at me, and from I think one of the things that the Buddha encourages us to be contemplating. Different realities of human existence that we should be contemplating every single day. Sort of, I'm of the nature to age, I've not gone beyond aging. I'm of the nature to sicken, I've not gone beyond sickness. I'm of the nature to die, I've not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So the truth of impermanence, change, separation from the loved. And then the last one, I'm the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related to my actions, abide supported by my actions. Whatever I will do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So that recognition of a fundamental law of cause and effect according to our actions, and that we receive the fruits of our actions. So that those reflections help us to have a a willingness to contemplate the natural occurrence of, say, aging, illness, death, whether it's ourselves or others, or separation from the loved, whether it's material, you know, other persons, material things, our own mental states. So that's a constant truth that we need to familiarize ourselves in order to establish a quality of clarity and equanimity. Not because, or not just to be like fatalistic and negative, but to recognize, well, that's actually the true nature of things. Nature is following its course. And whenever you start to get into a fight with nature, you always lose. So that it's a giving a opportunity to put it in a broader perspective, and then also that the feeling, of course, when something changes, something's difficult, is that it's about me. And in reality, this is a universal truth. And we're not actually accepted. There's no exception. It isn't just something that happens to other people. It happens to us. It happens to everybody. Because what makes it very heavy is the me bit. And it's like it's like with Ajahn Chah sort of saying with this big rock, on its own, when seeing it in its context of its nature, then it's not heavy. It's when I go and try to pick it up and carry it, that's when it becomes heavy. So the same happens with our interactions with with the world around us, our relationships with other people. And that doesn't mean that we try to push anything away, but it's really like attending to things in a way of kindness and wisdom. Those are the one needs to have that kindness and wisdom in our relationships with others, because that's a source of happiness, and it's a source of well, both for ourselves and for others. And when we attend to that, but then we're also ready for whatever change is going to happen, then we have the discernment and clarity of mind to not be shaken by natural change.
Sadhu Ajahn, you said in the chanting, I am the heir of my karma. So gam in Thai is the what we cultivate, body, speech, and mind, right? But in the Thai concept, we also have a jao gam nai wen. So can the Ajahn please help me to sort this out because till come my wins.
Well, I don't want to try and sort it out at all. It's not Buddhist. It's not in the Buddhist teachings. It's not in the Buddhist scriptures. I don't want to even go there.
So it's not.
So I mean, I don't say that it doesn't exist. I don't say that. It's a whole other layer outside of the teachings that I don't. No, but, it's just too complicated.
But the reason that I'm asking is because I'm going through the process of my mother who is dying, and she's 88, and she has been had a plane accident for like 20 years, and she could not walk, completely immobile, and her life in 20 years is like, it's not her karma, that's what I saw, I don't know. But in Thai, we often think, Ma must have tham kam wen wa ye. This is a jo kam nai wen must have been chasing after her. So this is may sound silly at times, but
yeah, it's a good story, but I don't know. To me it's just a story.
Yeah. So I just don't have the reason to look at my mother dying and very painful death, and so why my mother? So that's the question. Yeah, so much in pain.
That constant why, that in itself that's a lot of suffering.
Yes.
The main thing is not why. Main thing is how do you give attention to your mother, support her, care for her, make her feel safe, and look after her physical needs, but also try to look after her emotional needs. That's something you can do. The figuring out the why is something that, as human beings, it doesn't matter what culture, we have these complicated stories of trying to make sense of it. And you know, the Buddha he puts down a principle. There's these principles that are there, but he's not trying to fill in the whole story. And the reality is that when we attend to that, because say your mother is sick, we're all dying actually, but it's more overt, so that looking after her, that's something you can be doing that is wholesome, is positive, you can feel good about that. Trying to figure out the why of it, there's no way you can feel good about it. it's just adding a layer of complexity and complication that is not necessary.
Anyway, what I figure out is that being born is suffering enough, being born. So that's how I see it.
Yeah.
So maybe I get that point.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Thank you very
much.
Yeah,
just keeping it simple.
Any other questions?